This is Whitley Strieber. This is a Dreamland special event. We have an absolutely extraordinary program today. Linda Bolton Howe has just finished interviewing Gary McKinnon, a British subject who is liable at any time to be extradited to the United States to serve what could be a 60-year sentence for attempting to find out the truth about UFOs and zero-point energy by hacking into NASA and Defense Department computers from his kitchen over a dial-up modem in the UK in 2001 and 2002. They're trying to throw the book at him because he's embarrassed, because they're embarrassed. But what did he find out? Well, it's quite fascinating. You'll find out yourself what he managed to discover. But before we get into that, this is going to be a program presented without commercial interruption. It has cost money to make this, and I urge you to subscribe to UnknownCountry.com because that's how we keep going. We can't do it without you, and one of the reasons you're hearing this searching and detailed interview with this gentleman on this show and not anywhere else is that we are subscriber-based. We are subscriber-supported, so we're free to do pretty much what we want, or in this case, what we dare. So subscribe to UnknownCountry.com. It's a wonderful, wonderful subscriber section in addition to being a useful and important thing to do. Only 2 or 3 out of every 100 of you listening to this are subscribers. So take it on yourself. It's time to become responsible for this thing. Also, the UnknownCountry.com store is just terrific. It's run by Al Harlow. It's got the personal touch. It is not a big anonymous online business. It's a little online corner bookstore that happens to be filled with some of the most remarkable books in the world, all of them read by me and Ann, most of them by authors who have been interviewed on Dreamland, so you know they're just terrific. And earthfiles.com, Linda Moulton Howe's website. What more can I say about it, except it is a truly amazing resource. What will the general media pass over in the world of science and the edge of science? Well, practically everything important. If you want to know what's really going on in this world, you have to visit earthfiles.com. And now, here's Linda Moulton Howe.
And thank you, Whitley. I think that this is an extremely important story because once upon a time in the 1500s, the only way information reached the world was by pigeons, horseback, and sailing ships. And in that 16th century, as today in the 21st century, the common citizens were taxed, manipulated, and controlled by the power greed structures of various government entities, riding by horseback to help the commoners, at least in literature, was a generous and caring soul named Robin Hood. He stole from the rich to share with the poor, and his name became a symbol for championing the rights of the common citizen in the face of bullying and arrogant corporate and political hierarchies. In early 2000, a modern electronic Robin Hood emerged. He is a 34-year-old self-taught internet technology consultant in London. He was frustrated to see all kinds of information and speculation on the web about secret American technologies back-engineered allegedly from recovered extraterrestrial craft which could solve the world's energy and transportation problems. His name is Gary McKinnon. Gary knew that his mother's London water and heating bills were rising every year and resented the unfairness that so many people, especially pensioners, would suffer to simply stay warm in winter and cool in the summer. Some people even die unable to pay utility bills. So Gary decided to look for hard evidence of that anti-gravity technology and zero-point energy technology that he kept reading about. What if such energy breakthroughs might already exist in secret, compartmentalized American government projects? Gary thought if he could prove such energy systems did exist, he would report what he found to the world and let the chips fall where they might. He wanted truth to overwhelm the national security lies in the U.S. and his own country, England. Gary had also read about Donna Hare, a woman who had worked at the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, as a slide technician in the 1960s. Her office was in Building 8, a building that required a secret clearance to enter, since Donna had a secret clearance and had received NASA's 1969 Apollo Achievement Award and several other honors for her technical artist skills, she assumed she could go anywhere in Building 8. And one night there, she visited a fellow technician. She has since reported publicly about what happened in a May 6, 1995 WOL-AM radio broadcast from Baltimore, Maryland. In a transcript made of that broadcast, Donna Hare said, quote, "While I was there, I was trying to learn new methods and new things about the whole NASA photo organization. I was looking at pictures, and my friend directed my attention to one area on a photograph. There was a white, circular-shaped dot in the black and white photo. I asked him if it was a spot on the emulsion. He said, 'I can't tell you, but spots on the emulsion do not leave round circles of shadows underneath. I also noticed that there were pine trees, and I did notice there was a shadow under the white dot, and the trees were casting shadows in the same direction as the circle shadow of whatever the aerial phenomenon was, because it was higher than the trees, but not too much higher. I asked, "Is that a UFO?" And my friend said, "I can't tell you." I asked what he was going to do with that photo. And he said, quote, "We have to airbrush these things out before we sell these photographs to the public," unquote. Gary McKinnon also read about Donna Hare's firsthand information that NASA airbrushed out UFOs from these NASA photographs. So he wanted to see if he could find any similar original UFO photographs in NASA computer files that had not been airbrushed. Gary created commands for his computer to look up ranges of Internet protocol addresses to find out which were used by NASA and American military sites. His search began in early 2000 and extended to early 2002. During those 2 years, he found one list entitled, quote, "Non-terrestrial officers associated with what Gary thinks is an off-planet operation, perhaps to weaponize space." He also saw a NASA photograph from the point of view of the upper atmosphere looking down toward Earth. In the foreground, very close up, was a bizarre object unlike anything Gary had ever seen before. The shape was a cigar pointed at both ends, and the cigar had four geodesic dome structures. Gary could not see any rivets or seams and thought that he was most likely looking at extraterrestrial technology. That night in early 2002, while he was studying the cigar object in the NASA photograph, Gary was cut off by whoever the NASA operator was of that particular computer. In March 2002, Gary McKinnon was arrested in London by authorities from the National High Tech Crime Unit, which has now been absorbed into a newly formed intelligence agency called Serious Organized Crime Association, or SOCA. Originally, Gary was going to be penalized under Britain's Computer Misuse Act. Maximum sentence would have been 6 months in jail and or community service. But by November of 2002, the American Department of Justice intervened in his case and said the DOJ would pursue Gary's extradition to the United States for the alleged hacking damage that he had caused to American government computers. Now, in June 2006, Gary and his English attorney say he did no damage to American computers, and they are fighting the extradition proceedings, which might last for another 5 years if taken to the European Court of Human Rights. I talked by phone with Gary McKinnon this week at his London home. Since it is illegal to hack into computers, especially military and government ones, I asked him to first comment on the American extradition request.
I obviously absolutely agree that it is illegal. You know, you can't contravene the law. Extraterrestrial craft via secret compartmented projects of the American government as well as others. So I felt that the world needs this free energy technology.
Could you explain a bit more for the general audience about why you feel that it is justified to hack into areas that may have information about free energy and neutralizing gravity?
First of all, I wouldn't like to say to everyone that it's justified. I was on my own. I felt that we're not getting the truth from the scientists and the government because they don't know the truth. These black projects, if you will, are conducted, you know, outside of the normal governmental oversight. In Britain, for instance, we have old age pensioners dying because they can't afford to warm themselves, because they can't afford the fuel bills, which have gone up 65% in the last 2 years. And so to have good evidence, or to think you might have a chance of getting good evidence that the technology exists whereby everyone could warm themselves for free and eat their food and have their baths and whatever, then I felt I was morally justified at the time.
How did you go about your first searches, and how did you accomplish breaking in?
Okay, this isn't something you do through Google. These were private military networks. They weren't websites. There's a finite address space on the internet. It's around 40 billion different IP addresses. And every time someone has an IP address, which is just like a street number, your house number on the street or your apartment number, you have to register that address with naming authorities. And there are various commands you can do on a computer to look up ranges of IP addresses and find out from the naming authorities in that country who owns those IP addresses. So that's what you do to locate the networks.
What were the first subjects that you were looking for?
I felt that since the UFOs were the source of this technology, and this free energy technology in particular, and that there are so many sightings in America and lots of rumors of secret parts of the government having recovered ET craft and, you know, researched and investigated them thoroughly, that perhaps the best places would be to start with military sites.
And what was the first provocative information you remember finding?
I think the first thing was an Excel spreadsheet, the title of which was Non-Terrestrial Offices.
Non-Terrestrial Offices?
Precisely. Non-Terrestrial Offices. O-F-F-I-C-E-R-S.
And what did it say?
The Non-Terrestrial Personnel. It was basically an administrative worksheet. It was literally just a list of names and ranks. But nowhere, when you do web searches, or even in official Army, Navy, Air Force publications and literature, that phrase is nowhere to be found. So at first I thought, well, you know, I didn't get my hopes up and thinking, yeah, this is some kind of a literally non-terrestrial, like a non-human office. I thought it must be some kind of space-based terrestrial fleet, you know, people from Earth, but that a terrestrial fleet was being developed. And that coincided with finding another document, which had lists of ship-to-ship and fleet-to-fleet material transfers, and none of the ship names matched up to U.S. Navy ships. So the circumstantial evidence to me pointed towards the development of a new space-going force, and hence the weaponization of space.
And non-terrestrial meaning not down on the Earth and not near the Earth?
Precisely, just based off planet.
What was the next words or information that stood out that you found in your UFO search?
Unfortunately, there was only one more, but for me this was a convincing thing, a smoking gun, as it were. I'm sure you're aware of the Disclosure Project, run by Stephen Greer.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, The State Cell, there's an ex-NASA photographic expert, I think her name was Donna Hare. Yeah, Donna Hare. And she said she had secret clearance in Building 8 in Johnson Space Center. There were various projects going on, but they all had secret clearance, but you had to have a need to know, so you couldn't really tiptoe into each other's projects and have a look. But some of her colleagues that she'd worked before and knew, you know, on quite a friendly basis, were working okay, I'll use my same method, which wasn't very clever hacking, unlike the media would have you believe. I used lots of other people's programs joined together to search for blank passwords. I used the same method in Johnson Space Center. Found plenty of blank passwords, as was quite common, unfortunately. And used various network commands to strip out the machines that were in Building 8. Again, did a sort of thumbnail scan on those machines and stripped out the ones with blank passwords there.
And before we go into what you found, just for clarity, could you explain one more time why you don't consider this hacking, that what you are basically finding is weak security?
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. I'm glad you slowed me down on that one. Yeah, the reason I didn't consider it hacking, it was more like logging on. It was a sort of one-trick pony. I was looking for blank passwords. There were no firewalls to begin with, otherwise you wouldn't be able to log on from outside to the private network.
No firewall.
No firewalls at all. And secondly, no passwords. And it wasn't just an ordinary user. I was looking for administrator-level passwords. Administrator is a built-in account in most Windows operating systems that has full control over the one machine, the local machine that it's on.
At the management level in NASA, where an administrator would have a lot of people working under them, that person's computer did not have a firewall or a password. It was a default system?
Precisely, yeah. Yeah. And I think part of the trouble is that rather than if you're working in a huge organization, and I know this from IT support for banks and whatnot, if you want everyone to have Windows, you don't run around with one CD to everyone's machine. You create what they call an image of Windows and all the Office software you're going to use, and then you go across the network and write that image to every single machine's hard drive. And so it's a systems administration method of making your work easier. And I think on some occasions, because you're on a network level, then people don't generally log in as the administrator on every single machine. If you leave the password blank on the image and then write that image to every single machine on the network, then unfortunately every single machine is compromised. That wasn't the way on every network. That did happen on a few, where literally thousands of machines had a completely blank password.
So technically, from your point of view, in those accesses, you are not hacking. You simply have found an insecure system in which you are able to bypass the default instead of a password.
Precisely, yeah, and it's literally just logging on. Although, you know, I would like to stipulate it is still illegal because you're not the legal owner of those credentials.
Right. Okay, now, proceed with what you found.
Okay, so Donna here, ex-NASA photographic expert, had said she'd seen these airbrushing out portfolios in Building 8 and Johnson Space Center. When I finally got down to those machines, the first machine I was on, I think, because I think the whole part of that building is used for this purpose. These images were 200 to 300 megabytes in size. But bearing in mind, this was before Britain had broadband. I was on a 56K dial-up modem. And, yeah, that's like 5 minutes per megabyte. There was no way on earth I was going to download this one machine. But the program I was using for remote control of the machines, once you'd logged on as administrator, gave you graphical control so you could sit there in London, in my kitchen, and then be looking at the screen just as if you were sitting on a chair in front of the actual monitor where the Johnson Space Center is.
Wow.
And also the images were in a proprietary format. They weren't normal JPEGs or GIFs or anything we're used to seeing. So I decided the best thing to do was to navigate to one of the images on a folder from the Windows desktop and just double-click it and hope that they had the right application software running so that it would just come into view. And it did. But because of the size and stuff, I still had to turn it down to very low color. I think it's like 4 colors instead of 16 million. Very low screen resolution. And even then, because the files are huge, it still took a while to actually come down the screen. And what I saw, I was expecting what Donna had described, you know, sources above the Earth with maybe landmasses outlined and shadows, etc. But the one I got a chance to look at had the bottom two-thirds of the screen with the curvature in the top.
That you're seeing the curvature of the Earth below the object?
That's correct, yeah. Well, I assume it was the Earth. There were no landmasses visible, but it was, you know, a familiar sort of blue and white swirl.
Okay, so we are looking in color.
It wasn't true color. It was what they call cross-hatching or shading. Once you're down to 4-bit or 8-bit color, you are seeing shades of color. You're not seeing actual blue.
Okay.
But it has familiar sort of cloud patterns, just as we're seeing from the space shuttle and shuttle shop.
So now, you've got the curve of the recognizable Earth from space that we've all seen from the space shuttle, what else is there in detail?
Right, hanging sort of midway between the sort of camera viewpoint and the Earth's surface or the planet's surface, there was a very smooth, almost classic cigar-shaped object positioned so it's going horizontally, with almost very finely pointed ends to the cigar, so it wasn't your classic blunt-ended cigar. And above and below and to the right and to the left, it had sort of geodetic domes, you know, sort of golf ball shape. On closer inspection, there were no rivets, there were no seams, there were no nuts and bolts, there were no telemetry aerials, there were no windows, there was nothing. It just looked unlike anything man-made. It did have a strange look that either it must be very advanced and secretive or not of this Earth.
Do you remember anything about how many facets there were on each one of the spheres?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very, very clearly, because I happen to be, I've got a great interest in programming computer graphics, so I always notice, you know, facets and polygons or whatever. These were very like golf balls, they were highly multifaceted. It wasn't, you know, like split into 8 or 16 or 32, you know, you're talking, and it was a half a sphere.
It was a half?
Actually, no, on the left and the right it might have been, I think the left and the right was slightly over halfway, but the top and the bottom were definitely half. It did slightly remind me, we've got a place over here called Memris Hill, and they have the sort of golf ball radar stations, but there, there's many less facets to those, but it did remind me kind of of those, the way it was kind of flanged and joined together, you know, no seams, it looked like one entire shape. It was either very, very advanced or not manufactured by people.
Gary, did you ever see at that time anything on the NASA screen that said non-terrestrial, or extraterrestrial biological entity, or any words that would relate anything that you saw specifically to an extraterrestrial intelligence?
Unfortunately, no. When I basically got into the networks, I ran a program to search the files for keywords, you know, the long list of which, most of what you just mentioned were included. And apart from that Excel spreadsheet, no, nothing on NASA about extraterrestrials.
What about other agencies?
Well, yeah, obviously the Excel spreadsheet and the document about fleet-to-fleet transfers were both from the same network.
You're not sure if the non-terrestrial on the Excel spreadsheet of non-terrestrial personnel was in any particular American agency such as Army, Air Force, Pentagon, or so forth?
I'm pretty sure it was an Army network. In fact, it may even have been China Lake, actually.
Okay, that is important.
No, I'm just trying to put my mind back to then and kind of, because it was towards the end, you know, before I got caught. I think this is probably late 2001. Either China Lake or Fort, how do you guys pronounce it, Huachuca?
Fort Huachuca in Arizona.
Huachuca. Is that how you say it, Huachuca?
Mm-hmm. Fort Huachuca has been long linked to extraterrestrial cover-up, and so has China Lake.
Right, see, this is what amazes me. At the time I was doing this, I was playing it blind a lot of the time. In fact, you know, sometimes I wasn't really sure what the function of the network I was on was. You know, I think I may have, you know, been in places that were more sensitive than I even realized at the time.
And you have come across and remember China Lake and Fort Huachuca without knowing much about them.
Yeah, the reason I remember them, they were huge, huge networks. Typically, you get a few hundred machines, then on those, and Fort Belvoir, I think, which is what connected me to Huachuca. You're talking, you know, 5,000 machines per network that were, you know, wide open. And that's where I think they've used that imaging technique, whereby you've got a, unfortunately, you've got a blank password on many, many, many machines. That's why I remember the names. I remember spending a long time in those networks.
And Fort Belvoir is where the CIA is largely connected, as well as other things, right?
So, is that public knowledge?
I have certainly reported this in connection to interviews that I have done with a man who told me about his work for the Central Intelligence Agency in the 1950s, in which they screened 16-millimeter film of UFOs in the air, that they screened autopsies on non-human extraterrestrial biological entities, where they looked at photographs of both craft and entities from other places in the world. In this period where you are now trying to follow up on the woman who had worked for NASA and who was testifying that she had been in a room where they had folders called filtered, unfiltered, processed, and raw. And that a man was explaining to her at the Johnson Space Center that they regularly airbrushed out images of UFOs from high-resolution satellite images.
Yeah.
I wonder, did you come across anything having to do with altering Martian images such as Cydonia?
Oh, no, I wish I had, because that's something I've seen a lot about, actually, and it was very strange to me that the last Mars expedition, the communications were scrambled, and all the TV pictures weren't live for a change. It's the first time in NASA history that the images have been shown later. No, absolutely not. Well, mainly because when I was viewing that image on the screen, someone on a machine in the office was still, you know, awaking at work, and I think I must have been creating so much network traffic, or they may have seen it on the screen itself. I know, I think they saw it on the screen itself, because you saw the mouse move across the screen, right-click the local area network icon and choose disconnect, and hats off to NASA, that was me out, and I couldn't get back in using the same method. They closed off the Windows port 139 scanning method.
I see, so you...
It was a horrible moment, you know, it was very triumphal, but it was also the moment I got caught, and I felt, you know, really bad at the time. I thought, crikey, I've just discovered what I've been looking for 2 years, and at the same time got caught while finding it.
I think you told a BBC interviewer about a very unusual and strange moment when you thought you were working nighttime, but there was a network engineer who suddenly was communicating with you. Can you talk about that?
Oh, that was incredibly strange. I can't remember where I was, but again, it's this graphical remote control, which is quite silly, really. I'm sure a proper hacker would find other way to interact with the machine rather than, you know, moving a pointer very visibly across the desktop. But suddenly word pads appeared on the screen. They do start programs, accessories, word pad. It just appeared on the screen and someone typed, "Who are you?" They'd obviously seen me moving the mouse around and stuff. And I had to think on my feet, so I pretended to this guy at Hubs from the NIPANET, which is the American military's unclassified network, sensitive but unclassified. I pretended to him that I was an internet security engineer and that I'd discovered some unauthorized scans coming from this machine. So I was basically using what I was actually doing as a cover to pretend to this guy that I was an official presence.
And would you spell the name of that military computer security?
Yeah, NIPANET. NIPRNET. I think it stands for Non-Classified Internet Protocol and Router Network.
Do you remember what network engineer, what was the context? Was it Army or Navy or Defense Department or?
It was most probably Army or Navy.
Why would that network engineer in perhaps the Navy or the Army have accepted your explanation that you were working for that military computer security?
The explanation for that was exhibited very well in his behavior. Having told him that I was from NIPANET Security, Human Nature took over, and he immediately tried to start impressing me with his knowledge. And he ran a virus scan, he had a poor scanner thing, and started doing checks on the machine whilst communicating with me on WordPad. So it was Human Nature, you know, if someone accepts that kind of untruth, and then they go to work trying to impress you.
Have you had anyone from military or civilian intelligence in England or the United States make contact with you confidentially to support the fact that there is UFO knowledge of extraterrestrials and back engineering of such technology?
I've had contact, but not to confirm the phenomena, no. These are people that are trying to help me.
Okay. And the implication then would be, if they are trying to help, it's because they know that the truth is that what you are going after exists.
That's a very logical assumption based on the facts.
Could you please explain between 2002 and 2006 what has happened in the legal system between you in England, which is your home country, and the United States?
Well, the original arrest was by something called the National High-Tech Crime Unit here in England.
And it is officed in which agency?
they no longer exist. They've been absorbed into a new super agency, which is the equivalent of the FBI, called SOCA, the Serious Organized Crime Association.
What happened with this arrest and what's happened since?
So, initial arrest, 2002, March. I was told by the arresting officers that, you know, you'd get, under the Computer Misuse Act in Britain, 6 months to a year in prison, but most probably community service. I was on police bail, which is, you don't pay any money, they just trust you to, you know, not run away. Mm-hmm. And I did two police interviews during the same year, 2002. The first of which was very friendly, and it was, you know, they were kind of laughing and joking about, you know, little green men, etc., etc. But in between the first and the second interview, the National High Tech Crime Unit went over to the Office of Naval Investigation, I think in Washington, and they came back with a very, very much more serious, heavy attitude. I think they seemed to be very, very impressed by the top brass over there. After that second interview in November of the same year, 2002, then came the threats from the Department of Justice that they would intend to pursue an extradition case, which is unheard of, you know, in computer hacking.
Gary, what were the grounds that the American Department of Justice was saying that they could extradite you, an English citizen, who your government was prepared to penalize you under your Computer Misuse Act?
Okay, well, in 2002, Britain was under the auspices of one of our older extradition bills. I think it goes back to 1989. But having made the threats, the DOJ didn't actually pursue the application and put forward a formal request until 2004, which was a year after a brand new UK-US only extradition treaty, the 2003 UK-US extradition treaty, which actually changed the face of extradition law in that it put no pressure on the requesting party, i.e. the people that want to extradite you, i.e. America in this case. It put no pressure on them to provide evidence at all. You used to have to provide what's called prima facie evidence, a solid case, to give, you know, good solid grounds and evidence being the key as to why this person should be extradited. So me and my legal team think that there's a definite tactical delay on behalf of the DOJ to wait until there's a law in place, which makes it easier. And bear in mind, this 2003 treaty was formulated to enable the fast-tracking of terrorist subjects, and it's being absolutely misused now. The Unit for White-Collar Crime, etc., has been used and abused. And on top of that, not only is it being misused, it's only been signed by the British Congress or the Senate or whoever does that job on your end hasn't ratified it yet. So it's a one-sided treaty, which I think, I may be wrong, but I think is illegal under international treaty law. So that was a tactical delay. So I had from the threat in late 2002 until mid-2004, with nothing happening, thinking, you know, what's going on, it's still hanging over your head. And I wasn't actually finally rearrested until June of 2005.
And that rearrest was why?
Because they put forward the indictment and put forward a warrant for arrest for extradition that actually formalized the extradition request rather than saying, oh, we intend to extradite you. They actually waited until the act was in place and put forward a formal request, which ended up being an arrest warrant for the British police to pick me up.
But you're saying it was initiated by the American Department of Justice?
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, I missed out an important point. The National High Tech Crime Unit was very angry because what's called the CPS over here, the Crown Prosecution Service, they're a kind of intermediary above the police, they decided to hand it over from the National High Tech Crime Unit to the American authorities. And the NHTCU, National High Tech Crime Unit, were very angry because a high-profile arrest case in cybercrime, which is their field of endeavour, feather in your cap, you get a bigger budget, you get more respect, etc., etc. But when I asked someone quite high up in the CPS why this happens, why it gets handed over the plate from one government to another, well, I could very well be, you know, tried and prosecuted in my own country, he said this came from way over my head, it came from very high up. Now, whether or not that means someone in the Crown Prosecution Service above him gave the go-ahead, or there's some political shenanigans going on, and someone in the top brass connected to ET Research and said, we really want this guy, then my government said, okay, yep, you can have him. Who knows? The strange thing about this is America has made extradition agreements with, I think, 119, 120 countries, and only two of those countries will extradite their own citizens without any evidence, and that's Britain and Ireland. And America didn't ask publicly for this stipulation. Britain seemed to hand it over a plate.
And to date, as you and I speak on Monday, June 5th, 2006, United States Congress or agency in our government has still not signed this extradition treaty with England?
That surprised me, yeah. That's exactly true. In fact, the last meeting the Senate had was behind closed doors, and there was no report on what they said, but there was still the overall feeling that came out of it was that they just refused to move forward on it. I think there were some complications to do with the IRA and Irish nationals living in America. He has a huge Irish backlash to it.
But Gary, if our country has not signed off on this extradition treaty with England, how could we be extraditing you to the U.S. in this month of June if that is the current proposed plan?
That's a very good question. I think, you know, a treaty implies, obviously more than one partner to it. You would assume that everyone would have to sign it for it to be in a full legal effect. But Britain has just been running ahead saying yes to every request without evidence. No evidence at all. You have to identify this is the person you want and have an affidavit by a so-called expert saying we accuse him of this, this, that and the other. A one-sided treaty, you've never heard of such a thing. And also it's retrospective. So although I was elected in March 2002, a treaty enacted in late 2003, which was rushed through Parliament here in England, by the way, at a time when most MPs were on holiday near Christmas time and they used something called the Queen's Statutory Instrument, which is a special way of forcing something through. Yes, I'm not very happy with the law surrounding it. I wanted the child to be tried in my own country under my own law system.
And the treaty that was ran through during the Christmas holiday and still has not been signed by the United States would be retroactive to which year?
That's a very good question. I think there's no backwards limit.
And what does your lawyer think about the chance of your defeating the extradition request?
I think on the face of it, it's kind of unlikely the way things are going, you know, the erosion of civil liberties, especially since Britain and the US, as you said, are such great partners. We're also great partners when it comes to erosing our citizens' of civil liberties, and you very much, if you look at the changes in health and education over here, the kind of parallel the changes in health and education in your own country, I think we've almost got a copycat government over here. So on the face of it, not very hopeful, but if you get the public awareness, in America you've got a great tradition of the government's really listening to public pressure, and that's a really healthy thing about your system over there. Over here, they don't really tend to listen quite so much. But that's what we're trying to do. I think she thinks if we can get the public's opinion behind us, get enough people to speak up and see how unfair the law is, then if enough people listen and get it aired widely enough, then hopefully it'll change the law. All I'm asking is for a fair trial in my own country.
And Whitley, I am trying to get real clarity from somebody in Congress about what the status truly is of an extradition treaty between the United Kingdom and the United States, allegedly put together in 2003, being used against terrorists, and in this case, against Gary McKinnon, who has been, by the United States government, classified as a cyber terrorist, and that this extradition treaty, if it has not been ratified, which I will find out further and report back at Dreamland and Earth Files, if it has not been ratified, what is going on between England and the United States where this kind of pushing an extradition order against an English citizen could prevail? And his lawyer, that's where they think they have a lot of grounds here for fighting. And right now, if they go to the European Court of Human Rights, which is what Gary McKinnon's attorney now plans to do, they could tie this process up for 5 years. In the meantime, I think that this is a red flag to all of us in the United States and England that laws are being rammed through secretly that can tie people up in ways that perhaps even the people who wrote the original laws never intended.
Well, this treaty has been extraordinarily criticized in the UK by business interests in the UK. business leaders, opposition politicians, human rights groups. There are a number of high-profile extradition cases that are currently being fought in the British courts because people can be extradited to be witnesses in trials now. They don't even have to have been accused of a crime under this treaty.
Gary told me that the Department of Justice threat on this extradition included the suggestion that he would be put in prison in Guantanamo.
He was a kitchen table hacker without even much knowledge of what he was doing, and he succeeded in going into computers that didn't even have firewalls. It's disgraceful.
Or passwords.
Disgraceful.
But it was by default on thousands of machines.
Yeah, in 2002, after 9/11, or even before 9/11, that these computers weren't adequately protected at all. And he doesn't say this in his interview with you, but in his interview with the BBC website Click, he states that there were foreign hackers in these computer systems all over the world. He was able to see that they were constantly being hacked by foreign nationals from other countries. In other words, it's open sesame on American secrets to practically anybody except us. Just today, Linda, a story came through that the May the 22nd theft of data from the home, note, the home of a Veterans Administration employee did not just contain the social security numbers, birth dates, and names of 50,000 military personnel, which would be bad enough, but of virtually every active duty military person in the United States, to over 2 million people, plus, and this is almost unimaginable, all of their spouses, plus 26.5 million retired military and their spouses. And what does this mean? It means that these people, their spouses, their families, can now easily be located and identified by name wherever they live in the world. And I am telling you, if that data fell into the hands of terrorists, that's a prosecution we should pursue instead of this little guy. But they want to make an example of him because they're weak, they're flabby, they're incompetent, they can't keep us safe, and they can't keep our secrets.
And the historical irony that we've talked about before on Dreamland, and I have written about it at Earth Files, and that is all that he wanted to do was to see if he could prove that government agencies such as NASA and the military had real information about extraterrestrial vehicles and technology and back engineering technology secrets on free energy systems. And the irony on all of this is that our government of the United States appears now to be using terrorism as its catch-all word, whether it's going after real terrorists or it's trying to defeat honest investigations, and in this case, a guy wanted to find out information and report it to the world, and they're using terrorism as another cover-up lid, as they have used the issue of national security for 60 years. And when we realize that we have national security / terrorism, the catch-all in which anything and everything can now be hidden from citizens in the United States that are paying for this government, to me, we are so close to what once upon a time was called fascism, when the corporate and the government together ruled a nation.
Let's go on a little bit and discuss what he told us he had found. Now, he was on NIPRNet, which is the Non-Secure Internet Protocol Router Network. Unfortunately, it tells me two things. One is, he's not lying when he says he's no real hacker, because that network is readily accessible, and it's no wonder that computers on it didn't necessarily have password protection. I'm appalled that there were no firewalls. That's unpardonable. But this network is not intended for ultra-secure communications and ultra-secure files, for example, which makes me wonder about the value and the validity of what he did see, for example, these extraterrestrial officers, so-called. Was he looking at something from a video game, or was he looking at a real NASA document, or what exactly was he looking at?
Yeah, that was clearly non-terrestrial personnel officers. This was in an Army or Navy file.
My point is, it could have easily been something that's, and the reason that none of the ships were actually listed in any naval registries is it could have been something from some video game somebody was playing. That would certainly be the sort of thing that might end up on that network. And I don't think he had the capacity, from the way he described the system he was using, to really tell very much about the provenance of the files he was looking at.
He explained that it was a spreadsheet. That's important. This was not like a computer game at all. It was a spreadsheet of names and titles and assignments, and he used the term spreadsheet. And the title of it, of this spreadsheet, an accounting-like spreadsheet, said non-terrestrial officers, and then among those spreadsheets in that file were orders for ship to ship, a transfer of supplies, and he became very puzzled because he could not find any names of the ships that were being used in this spreadsheet in the non-terrestrial officers section that related to any ships that he could find were listed for American fleet.
I played such games for many years. I don't play them now because I don't have time. And we use spreadsheets routinely for that exact purpose. In other words, what I'm saying is it doesn't prove anything, frankly, mm-hmm. that it was a spreadsheet. And the graphic that he describes is...
as a photograph.
A photograph. He describes it as a photograph. I was very interested in that because it occurred to me the way the protocol that he was using and the reduction of down to four colors and the lack of resolution suggests that he saw that this thing was above an Earth-like planet or a planet, but he has no way of knowing where that planet was. And if it's an authentic photograph, maybe it's not even a photograph of something above the Earth. Maybe it's a photograph of something above another planet.
Yes, he even raised that as a possibility, but he thought that the swirl of clouds looked like photographs as we often see from the space shuttle.
It's all an extraordinary story, and it may be that he has identified in that spreadsheet a whole level of human activity that we have been prevented from knowing about, which is, if true, unpardonable. Unpardonable and unbelievably terrible. It makes it seem, and this is why I say it so advisedly, that this must be, the United States government must be one of the most evil institutions in the history of the planet, if not the most evil, to keep
it's
information like that away from the public, on the one hand. On the
it's
other
certainly
hand,
desperate.
Is it real? And I have my doubts, as I've expressed.
Yeah, at least our government is acting desperate.
Well, they are certainly after this poor guy.
Gary McKinnon and you and I and so many others are so concerned that what he has discovered in all of this is that all of our civil liberties now are jeopardized.
Well, they're in the hands of second-rate people, and yes, they are jeopardized. We've got Gary McKinnon where, Mr. Justice Department, is Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, and for people listening to Dreamland who would like to keep up with the developments in the Gary McKinnon case, I have a website listed at the bottom of my Earth Files report about the Gary McKinnon fight of extradition called freegary.co.uk, and you can go to the bottom of Earth Files and click on that hot link, and it takes you to a British website that is trying to report what is happening now in this issue over the Department of Justice wanting to extradite Gary McKinnon from England to the United States for prosecution and, as they said, a threat of Guantanamo.
Linda Moulton Howe, thank you very much for that special report. This weekend on Dreamland, PMH Atwater with an incredible new idea about children and how they are changing and how this relates to Mayan prophecy and the growth of consciousness on planet Earth. Don't miss it. It is so beautiful, so amazing, and so hopeful. And for our subscribers, an intimate discussion between two mothers, PMH Atwater and Ann Streber, that will touch your heart. Keep Unknown Country going. We depend on you. Subscribe today. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on that subscribe tab and join the very best subscriber section of its kind in the world. This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.